welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the State of the Unions. Probably too cute on that one. Richard, you've got a column out with defining ideas at hoover.org, looking at the state of labor unions in America. Long story short, the steady decline continues. Even at a time when we're adding new jobs, there's a net decrease in union membership. So if we take the long, and for that matter, stark view, the high watermark for private sector union membership as a percentage of the labor force was 35%. That's a number last reached in 1954. In 2019, it was down to 6.2%. And you, Richard Epstein, say that's a good thing. So, Richard, there are a lot of people out there who will say things like, unions gave us the middle class. It was unions that gave us the weekend. If that's the case, why cheer their decline?
Well, the question is, who gave what? And the first point to note is that there is nothing that a union does in order to increase productivity. What the basic raison d'etre of a union is to figure out how you put restrictions in place, which means that you have to force the employer to the bargaining table, and you have to exclude rival workers. You have to make sure that you can subcontract various kinds of work in order to be able to raise the raises for the existing employees. So if you're doing all of that, the question is, how are you giving the middle class? If it turns out prices of unionized goods are going to be higher and workers who are outside the particular system are not going to be able to command the same wages as everybody else, there is no way that you can create a union middle class by having less rather than more. So what is the alternative? Prior to the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, there were a large number of unions which were called company unions. These were declared expressly illegal under the 1935 Act under Section 8.2. You can't have a company union. Why is that? Because what company unions do is they are very good at working efficiencies by getting better communications to exist between employers and employees. But since they are under the thumb, as it were, of the employer, they're not going to go out on strike and they're not going to have all the restrictive practices on the other side. So if you want to imagine a competition between two firms, one of which is unionized from the outside and the other which only has a company union, if they start off on an equal position, after you go through a number of iterations, the unionized firm will fall far behind the non-unionized firm because they're going to constantly be having these struggles, these interruptions, these administrative costs, these breakdowns because of strikes and lockouts, whereas the other firm will incrementally improve itself by taking the sections of workers and putting them into business. Indeed, if you're a worker trying to go into one of these two settings, one of the nice things about going into the company union business is if you turn out to have some management aptitude, there's nothing whatsoever to prevent you from being promoted. Well, one of the really difficult things associated with unions is that if you cannot have company unions, it also is the case that you cannot have any direct conversation between the employer and the employee. The union always has to act as the intermediary. Once you put that intermediary into place, it becomes very difficult for workers to get the confidential information and the confidence of the various kinds of employers so that they could advance up the work. And so it would be common in the olden days to have secretaries and people who are floor managers show some executive ability, and they'd slowly be put up through the ranks, in some cases even becoming a major officer or even a chief executive of these firms. Unions kill upward mobility on that. They also impose all sorts of conflict of interest amongst various sorts of workers. So if you look at the unions in the case of expansion, everything seems to be kind of rosy. You're getting more people in there and so forth. But the moment there's a whiff of decline, and there's been a whiff of decline for the last 65 years, what happens is who takes it on the chops? And essentially with a union system, it turns out that the key problem is based on seniority. The longer you've been there, the more protections that you're going to have, which means that new workers on the one hand and recent hires on the other hand are going to be much more precarious in terms of what they can expect, because the senior guys controlling the union board and having the protection of explicit seniority are going to be able to get the lion's share of the game. Now, what are the gains that these people all want? Well, to some extent, it's wages, but more importantly, it's pensions. And so what you see in virtually all of these unions is that the elites constantly push for strong pension programs, and they're going to get it, whereas young workers who have to wait 20, 30, or even 40 years to pick them up are going to be hurt. And so if you're thinking about what a union is, don't be under the illusion that there's solidarity there from top to bottom. There are these real temporal conflicts of interest. In another kind of business, they're not going to be nearly as acute. You obviously have to give pensions to keep your senior workers there. But if you have a younger worker who could be promoted over a senior worker, you will do it. And in certain kinds of industries where you need technical skills that have to be constantly upgraded, for example, younger workers are generally going to outperform older workers. So what you need to do is to have a system whereby workers can be constantly moving in and out. A zero turnover rate is obviously too low. An incessant turnover rate is obviously too high. But if you're a management firm, what you try to do is to make sure that this goes. Now, what's going to happen to the senior workers? Well, if you have a unionized economy, it turns out all these other unions are going to have exclusive practices. It's going to be very difficult to get in. If you have a non-unionized economy, what will happen is there are now going to be places that will want to pick you up. So since we have a relatively small level of union participation, and now we have something of a Trump-like economic booms, the number of retirees who come back into the market and are able to find employment in a way that they find suitable for themselves is very, very high. You lock down an entire economy with a union, and that degree of labor flexibility is gone. So the simple situation is there's only one way in which you can create a middle class. That's to improve productivity. In the early days, when you had many inventions that did this, it turned out the productivity gains of the economy may have exceeded the union stuff. But if you follow the history of the unions from 1954 to the present, you could look at 1979, and that's a year in which General Motors had its notorious settlement, in which it turned out anybody who was laid off was put into the rubber room and got pensions for life. And by the time they were finished with this, how did you preserve the middle class? Well, you made the firm so infirm that of the 500,000 workers it had, 25 years, 30 years later, it was down to about 42,000 people. The major issue with respect to unions is, with this decline, who gets knocked out first? Do you do it by individual plans? Do you do it by regions? What kind of seniority do you use? A union situation cannot succeed because it's a rigid and inefficient kind of structure. And anybody who thinks you could reverse the fortunes of a middle class only has to look down into the engine room to see the way in which these negotiations take place, rather than having some idealized model in which you treat a union, which is typically dominated by the top, as an organization which is a pure plebiscitory democracy.
Now, I mentioned 6.2% of private sector workers are in unions. The number is much higher in the public sector. It's a little over a third of workers. Explain for our listeners why unions have not declined as steeply there.
Well, first of all, what happens is they're dealing against states as employers. And in many states, the marching orders are you do not fight unions in terms of their organizational preferences. You accept them there. And the only question is what kind of contracts that you have. And given the fact that unions have a strong degree of political clout, it turns out to the extent that they are able to make contributions to elect the right people to the right positions in the various kinds of state legislatures, they have the unique advantage of being on both sides of the bargaining table, at least in part, which is going to essentially make it much harder for anybody to try to resist them. In addition, it turns out that the entry problem is very different when you're looking at unions on the one hand in the public sector from those in the private sector. So I'm an automobile maker, and I don't think much about Japanese anything with respect to automobiles in 1965. But then all of a sudden you start seeing companies, cars coming from Germany and coming in from Japan. Then you see these companies opening up non-union plants in states like Tennessee and Mississippi, and all of a sudden you've got yourself a real competitor. And when you have that competitor, what you try to do is to unionize the other guys. And what's happened is most of the time the workers will not bite. Why won't they bite? Because what they realize is they're getting lower wages and lower fringe benefits, but they understand that the durability of their benefits is far greater than those of a union worker, which may have a glorious day today and a terrible future tomorrow when these plans shrink or they shut down. So they've never been able to unionize the South. And since they can't unionize the South, it places a necessary brake on what you can do as a union in the North. you now start looking at a teacher's union in a given jurisdiction. They have very few credible substitutes. So when they want to really hold out, it's not as though you have other private firms. These unions, of course, understand that there are sources of competition, their homeschooling, voucher programs, and so forth. And so they work overtime through their negotiations to have the state shut down these things. And if your name is Bill de Blasio and the union says, we don't want any co-location of basically voucher schools with unused space in city schools, he's going to try to oblige those sorts of things. And so you can't essentially have the competition to get it down. What's the most powerful union in a place like California? Answer, it's the prison guards. Well, what's the close substitute to the prison guard? There isn't any. And if it turns out that strike and you have all sorts of people being released into the streets, this is not going to be such a great idea. So the original view, which was held by people like George Meany and so forth back in 1935, was that we believe that unions work well in the private sector. There was no real sentiment to try and get it in the public sector. And Roosevelt, who was always cagey about these issues, did not really want public unions either. But starting in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, there was a huge movement in this direction. And in January, I believe it was, of 1962, John Kennedy made one of the great blunders of his president by announcing that he was going to give limited kinds of recognition for unions for bargaining on certain kinds of issues, which turned out to be all kinds of issues. And then you've got one state after another deciding to unionize its particular workers. And so you can see a rather unnerving correlation. The quality of public education goes down as the budgets and the union representation starts to go up. And what happens is every time the unions start to decline in quality, their claim is not to let people go. Their claim is you have to get rid of our competitors and you have to give us more money. So if you wanted to do the private analogy, you get a company like Nissan or Toyota that comes in and they make better cars than you have with the unionized plants of General Motors, Ford, or Chrysler. And the answer is, well, the way in which we improve total quality here is we shut down the non-union firms and put all the money into union firms so that we get the monopoly. And therefore, what happens is we'll do better. So the number of people who will be trapped in public schools without any option if these guys have their way is very, very large. Now, in response to this, there was the Janus case, which came out a couple of years ago, in which the effort was made to say that you don't have to pay for union dues if you're a teacher in a unionized school and you don't agree with the message. And they made this as a First Amendment argument. Freedom of speech is essentially upset by coerced behavior. The argument on the other side was these people are useless free riders doing all this. The reason that argument has always been situation is there are many teachers, I would certainly be one of them, who say, you give me union membership for free, I still don't want to have any part of what you're doing. I would always want to be a free agent in that kind of a system rather than be part of a collectivity. So what happens is the unions then try to make it impossible for people to withdraw by saying you could only withdraw on between Friday and Saturday of this particular week. And oh, by the way, it's the tax week. And if our forms aren't open in time, you don't get it. And there's just a huge amount of litigation as to what's going to happen to Janus. And it turns out in some places the decline in union membership is pretty high. In other places, it turns out to be lower. But I'm essentially a strong fan of the Calvert Coolidge position. His attitude was you never have a strike by public union ever. In fact, he got his national reputation by breaking the police strike in Boston in 1919. And my position is far from having governments decide that they're going to recognize unions, it's a complete breach of any public trust to decide to increase the cost that you have to pay for necessary services by turning your service market from a competitive into a monopoly position and paying premium. So I think, in effect, the current system is flatly unconstitutional. This is a minority of one. Everybody else tends to think in the opposite direction. But what happens when you read people like Michael Lynn and so forth and Jonathan Rauss, they forget and that the raison d'etre of unions is the exercise of monopoly power against the rest of the world and the peculiar form of income redistribution amongst union members based on seniority and other kinds of position. And I think, in effect, this is just not a tolerable state of affairs. I thought the National Labor Relations Act was unconstitutional when it was put into place. Everybody said, oh, well, you're a kook. It turned out there were three judges for a variety of three courts for a variety of reasons which struck this down before the United States Supreme Court improved it in a surprise decision 5-4 in a case called Jones and Laughlin back in 1937. So the old tradition goes back a long time. My favorite Justice Mahlon Pitney wrote the very strong opinions in which essentially he said mandatory collective bargaining imposed by the state on any private employer is essentially an infringement of freedom of contract. And my view is if it's imposed upon a public employer, then it's a breach of the public trust. So I have not mellowed on this particular issue. And I'm kind of sad to hear that so many of the so-called conservatives think that with all the difficulties in the work, the way you handle the problem of worker morale is to create unions. Most people don't want to be in unions. Most people have turnovers that aren't there. What you really need to do is not to force random employers to take this kind of relationship. You have to get the chattering classes, of which I'm a member, to actually speak with a little more decency and respect about people who do manual labor and other kinds of things. And what's happened is we've seen the market start to improve with respect to Trump, particularly at the bottom, particularly with students, particularly with minority members, particularly with former prisoners, particularly with old people. And why is that? Because there's a very powerful classical liberal explanation for it. The cost of unionization, the cost of other forms of regulation are roughly constant regardless of income level. So if you think about that, somebody's at the bottom of the system and he's having to pay these costs of X. He's doing it off a salary of Y. But the guy who's richer than him is doing it on X over 2Y. So it's a smaller fraction. So you're going to move to high-skilled labor in order to minimize the effect of regulation. Well, this works in both directions. You reduce the cost of regulation, it's going to have a larger effect, relatively speaking, on the people at the bottom of the income distribution than on the top of the distribution. And so they're going to come back into the economy with greater fury. And so what you have to explain and have to insist upon to the American left is the way in which you create additional opportunities for all workers and the level of respect and training that starts to go with it is to get rid of any kind of impediment to market transactions, minimum wage laws, family leave laws, anti-discrimination laws, labor union laws, you make it, fair labor standard laws, and so forth. What you need to do is to have an open labor market. The difference is this. You get increases in wages because of a monopoly power. Employers are going to fight you every way, shut down if necessary. You get an increase in wages because of productivity gains that you supply. The reaction of the employers, you do more stuff, I'll pay you more money. The only way I can get rich is to make you rich. So you have to figure out which of these two models you want, cooperation through trade to get joint gains or monopoly exaction in order to get joint losses. I don't think that's a particularly hard choice.
I should note for our listeners, you talked about conservatives who have developed a growing sympathy for labor unions. That's not conservatives across the board. The traditional opinion is generally closer to yours, but you reference in there Michael Lind, who has a new book out, Jonathan Rauch, who had a piece to this effect in The Atlantic a couple of years ago. Neither one of those guys are what we consider full-scale conservatives, but certainly people that conservatives have been sympathetic to over the years. And amongst conservative populace, there is sort of a growing feeling that maybe they should rethink the position of labor unions in the economy. I will close with this, Richard, from the other side of the ideological spectrum. So as you mentioned, organized labor is a major constituency of the Democratic Party. So these issues are a big priority for many progressive politicians as a result. And if people read your column at Defining Ideas, they can see your examination of some of the proposals that we've seen coming from Democratic presidential candidates on these issues. I just want to close with one because of an interesting tie-in it has with somebody who's generally considered sort of an intellectual cousin of yours. The proposal, has come from Pete Buttigieg. And the proposal is to ban right-to-work laws. These are laws that prohibit compulsory union membership as a term of employment. Now, the vast majority of free market types support right-to-work laws. But surprisingly enough, the late Milton Friedman, the legendary free market economist, did not. And he said, I'm quoting here, he said, quote, given competition among employers and employees, there seems to be no reason why employers should not be free to offer any terms they want to their employees. And also, this is a separate quote nearby. If in fact some employees would prefer to work in firms that have a closed shop and others in firms that have an open shop, there would develop different forms of employment contracts, some having the one provision, others the other provision. So, Richard, rare for us to find this much daylight between you and Milton Friedman. How do you respond to his argument?
Well, Milton was essentially not an institutional economist. If you'll notice, he did not mention the fact there's a national labor relations there. But I have taken exactly that same position. If it turns out that you've got no coercion to join a union, no exclusive situation, no state send, and a firm essentially wants to have a union and wants to have it a closed shop, and it's a mutual agreement to them, they will succeed if they can outperform their competitors, and they will fail if they cannot. But what happens in this particular case is you get monopoly extension. The guys who want the benefit of the right to work law don't get into the firm by a voluntary agreement. We know that under the current system, given that these are adversary and not company unions, that the number of employers who favor unionization on this world is under 1%, and the 1% who want it could always get it under some kind of term. And so what Milton is doing is he's presupposing an open economy and coming to the correct conclusion that if people want to form intermediates and want to have various kinds of group situations, that's fine. And if they don't want to do it, that's fine too. But there is never be, there never has been, there never was a situation of an adverse union that developed through the market processes before the adoption of the various kinds of pro-union legislation, starting essentially in the 1910s and so forth. You try to do it through state and federal laws on the railroads. Then the Railway Labor Act comes along, a complete disaster. You then have the National Labor Relations Act. It's only then that these issues come up. Because if you recall, the only reason you need a right to work law was part of the effort under Taft-Hartley, when they realized they couldn't undo unions entirely, to try to figure out how you could weaken the particular union by allowing workers to ask, opt out, no questions asked. And there's been a huge attack now on the fair pay rules, led in part by an opinion by my good friend Diane Wood, a judge, in a case called Pence, that's Mike Pence v. Sweeney, who was the head of the union, in which she said it is unconstitutional to have a right to work law unless the state provides a subsidy equal, roughly speaking, to the amount of payments that the free-riding union workers ought to get. I think the opinion is wrong for a large number of very technical reasons, but what happens is Milton is not talking about how this thing works in a system where you already have huge forms of separate federal intervention. He's talking about it in a market. In a market, you don't have to worry one way or another, but in the world of regulation and second best, repeal is often not possible. So what people try to do is, as you're dealing with a bull, is to throw a few harpoons into the thing in order to make sure that it moves a little bit more slowly. And that was the strategy that the Republicans adopted in 1947 when they passed the Taft-Hartley Act. And so you've got to look at it from a historical perspective. And once you do that, if you read Milton's quote again, you will see that there's not the slightest reference to sort of monopoly unionization. So he's right in a world that doesn't exist at the time that he made those statements.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can also follow him on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.